Hey, this is the Football Diary Podcast back again after the World Cup break and our first pod of 2023. It's great to be back. The Premier League's back. Thank you so much for joining us once again.
Yeah, it's our third year recording now, technically, as well, which is feels like a big thing for us, I think. So it's nice to have.
It's definitely become a part of our ritual, hasn't it? Hopefully it's part of yours as well back home. But yeah, where do you want to start this time, man? The Premier League's back. We've missed the first wave of Boxing Day fixtures, but should we start at the top of the table, maybe?
Yeah, at least it's given us a bit more of a wider picture and seeing if teams are being consistent after the World Cup, if it was just a blip. But yeah, Arsenal seems like the right place to start, really, doesn't it, with them being top still?
Yeah, I was going to say consistency with a massive gap in the middle. Is that even a concept anymore? But they've hit the ground running, haven't they? They've beaten Brighton 4-2 in what should have been a tricky away game, but they've now stretched their lead over City even further. Can you actually consider them as title favourites outright now? Because I know a lot of Arsenal fans are kind of reluctant to say that. And I think a lot of football fans generally are kind of thinking a bit like when Leicester were ahead and about to win the Premier League. Surely not. Surely something's going to happen. But Arsenal keep going, don't they?
Yeah, it's ridiculous. And this gap that's opened up will give them a bit of leverage now and give them a bit of freedom to kind of expand this squad and see where things take them. The City game's obviously still to come. Having a point gap big enough that they could survive two losses in that, in theory, and still be top of the league, that's fantastic. And when you consider that Man City have got 4 points from their last three games, while Arsenal are just winning and winning and winning, they have to be the favourites right now, really. And by merit, they're playing fantastic football. Some players are on absolutely top form. That's really helping them get through. What, like you say, this not just could have been, but probably was a difficult away fixture. And there were moments where it looked like Brighton might get back in the game. But Arsenal rode it out. And the quality they have in certain areas of the pitch, that did the talking for them, really, didn't it?
Yeah, I do think there's an element of like good fortune with the way they're playing at the minute, combined with just making their own luck as well. Because, I mean, within a couple of minutes, Saka gets the rub of the green, the ball falls to him and he finishes it really well. He's in great form at the minute. But then you've got the likes of Odegaard's goal was great to see. He's in such good form. Martinelli's goal, again, was really good. There were some impressive finishes there. And I think that's, for me, where Arsenal are kind of streaking ahead of the rest of the pack because they're taking the chances so well. And there were a few like defensive wobbles in this game. And I think there's a bit of fragility there for them. But going forwards, they're just a joy, aren't they, really?
Yeah, and particularly with Martin Odegaard, it's unreal the season he's having. Giving him the captain armband seems to have actually really paid off. He seems to be absolutely flourishing with that. And his creativity and his passing range is just phenomenal. His assist for Martinelli's goal is just outstanding. His little skill and trickery around the Brighton defenders, they didn't know how to handle him. And his finish was excellent as well. Really well taken. The way it got through that crowd of players, you just assumed it had a mad deflection or something. But it's not. He's just that accurate. And this is the player that really Real Madrid thought they were getting. He's absolutely phenomenal, and he could be the key to Arsenal's success this season. It'll be interesting to see how they deal with the Europa League coming back. I don't think they'll shy away from that competition, but their depth is slightly lower than others. But right now, it doesn't seem to matter. Nketiah has come in and been fantastic, done what he needed to do. Martinelli's stepping up, getting goals. Saka's stepping up and getting goals. Odegaard, obviously. It's really nice to see this squad gelling in that way and playing great football. And the issues at the back will sort themselves out. I think Saliba just has a bit of a World Cup hangover and he's getting back used to being in the Arsenal camp again. So he's had a couple of poor games, maybe. But when you're scoring four, you can allow for that a little bit, can't you?
Well, yeah, I think you've kind of hit the nail on the head with just strength in depth is probably the biggest weakness Arsenal have, and they haven't really been tested massively yet, apart from obviously Gabriel Jesus' absence, which hasn't been felt because Nketiah has stepped in so well. But the midfield is one of the strongest midfield trios now, I think, in the Premier League. Thomas Partey's been brilliant. Granit Xhaka's reborn, isn't he? And obviously Odegaard, like you say, pulling the strings. If one of those players was to be injured, however, I think they'd struggle to have quality enough to step up and replace them, even close to like for like. That, for me, is the biggest concern for Arsenal, don't you think?
Yeah, that might be fixed in January. Obviously, in the summer, it was well documented that they wanted Douglas Luiz. That didn't come off. But they obviously knew that the midfield was something they needed to target. I wouldn't be surprised if we saw Yuri Tielemans' name pop back up again. And I think there's certain players that could step in that it would be quite interesting to see. Elneny, for example, he's not of the quality of Thomas Partey, but he's been such a good servant for Arsenal that actually, with the rest of the team clicking, he would definitely do a job there. Someone like Fabio Vieira might be able to step into Odegaard's role. Again, not the same quality, but a very good replacement still. It'll be interesting to see what their priority is in January, whether they panic and buy another striker, or whether they stick to their plan. Obviously, the talk is about Mudryk.
Yeah.
An amazing player. I don't know how that fits Arsenal's system right now. Whether that
not only that, but ridiculous value attached to him as well. It's like 100 plus million quoted for him. And I think I'd worry as an Arsenal fan that the chemistry in the team is so finely balanced at the minute that if you were to put somebody in there, it'd have to be almost complementing what you already have from a team ethic point of view, from an age profile point of view. There's so many boxes that have been ticked by the recruitment in Arsenal's recruitment team lately that to get it wrong would be disastrous. So it's almost counterproductive if they don't get the next recruit or two perfect. It's got to be right at this stage of the season. So maybe you're right. Maybe they do trust the players they've got.
And they've got players to come back still. We've still got the likes of Emile Smith Rowe coming back in as well.
Yeah.
With Mudryk, it would be a phenomenal signing. He looks like a wonderful wingo. He brings a lot of pace. Absolutely ridiculous what he could do on the counter. I wonder if Arsenal spend that much money on a player when they have Saka on one side and Martinelli on the other. Where does he go? I don't really know what the long-term plan is if they bring him in. So Arsenal are in a position of strength. They're strengthening from there. That's only a good thing, really. And I can't see anything upsetting them right now. Obviously, they've got Newcastle midweek, and that is a big game. Both teams have had very successful starts to the season, really. I'm interested to see where that takes them, to be honest.
Yeah, I think with this performance in particular, you mentioned Brighton away, never an easy fixture, but Brighton have been in decent form under Roberto Di Zerbi, better than I think any of us probably expected since Graham Potter's left. And they could have actually got back into the game as well. There was a moment, wasn't there, where it could have been pulled back to 4-3. I think Arsenal were quite fortunate, and that's what I was talking about earlier with a little bit of luck on their side. Quite fortunate not to let it slip to 4-3. And that would have made it a different contest altogether, wouldn't they, really? Because Brighton were kind of finding their feet again, and fair play to them. They actually did take the game to Arsenal. They didn't sit deep. They didn't try and absorb pressure. Arsenal had the lion's share of possession, I think, but Brighton took the game to them in the end.
They did, but to be honest, I don't think Arsenal will feel too worried by that when they're putting up the kind of numbers they are. And actually, this weekend, even if they'd drawn this game to Brighton, wouldn't have been the end of the world with City dropping points, Spurs last, Newcastle drop points. It was a great weekend for Arsenal, to be honest. And any weekend that they score four goals, it's going to take a lot for a team to get really back into that game. So I don't think they ever felt uncomfortable with it. They've got some tests coming up. If they can see them out, you've got to consider them favourites now. And rightfully so. They've been phenomenal.
It's been a long time since any football fan's been looking at Arsenal and going, they're Premier League title favourites. And that still feels strange to say that. And I think that's part of the reason why when we look at Man City and especially their draw against Everton, we see it as a massive 2 points lost. But you have to remind yourself, City are only, I think, 2 points away from the same stage last season where they were. They're not like struggling badly, just that Arsenal are so good. They're so clinical, they're so consistent. But let's talk about City quickly. Dropping 2 points against Everton, it's a difficult game for them, wasn't it? Haaland once again scoring, I think, his 21st goal of the season. Do you reckon having him in the team is almost like counterproductive in some ways? It's making the dynamic elsewhere just not work.
No, no, I'll be honest, not at all. I've seen that kind of talked about a little bit. It was the same conversation with Ronaldo at United last year. When you've got a striker scoring all your goals, does it take away from the team play? With someone like Haaland, no, I don't think so at all. The kind of numbers he's posting, it's ridiculous. No one can expect that from one player, particularly in the Premier League. We never see this. I think he's three behind last season's top scorer already. And we're, 17 games into the season? So, I think he's been phenomenal. This was a blip, let's be totally honest. And he still scored in this game. I don't think you can lay much blame at his feet, to be honest. I watched this and I watched their game against Leeds and they're just getting back together. Bear in mind how many players City lost out at the World Cup. It's another thing where it might be a slight anomaly. Everton really needed a point. They were really, really desperate. And actually, they were very lucky to get a point in some ways. They ground it out. They defended well at times. Damari Gray's goal was absolutely excellent. All you need to do is look at the XG of these two sides and know that really City were robbed. But that's okay. Everton won't care about that. You have to do some work to even get to that stage in a match, particularly when you're one down to Man City. I think it's a great result for them. I don't think it's enough to give them any real hope for this season. And I don't think it's quite enough to write Man City off yet either. It's just one of those odd games you get in the middle of a season, really, isn't it?
Yeah, and like I say, I think just Arsenal's fine form has made any points drop from Man City look like a disaster. And it's really not. We know what City do in the second half of every season, without a doubt. They go on a run. And it's not just any old run. It's, you know, 10, 15 games unbeaten. Not even unbeaten, one in a row. And that's still to come, I think, from City. And I think the sort of second half and even the last third of the season, when squads are really going to be tested, that's when City will probably come to the fore very slightly. But those two games between City and Arsenal, they look tastier by the game week, don't they?
Yeah, I can't wait. Yeah, they're going to be absolutely phenomenal. We've got some good games this week, to be fair, because obviously, like I say, Arsenal have got Newcastle and City have got Chelsea, who are struggling in their own right. So it's really competitive at the top, but the more Arsenal open this gap up, the better for them, really, at this stage. You wouldn't have dreamed of 7 points ahead of City at this time of the season.
So Arsenal title favourites, you think. Too early to write off City, however. Everton, put up a good fight. And it was interesting to see the weird contest going on between Ben Godfrey and Erling Haaland as well. He was really fired up for that, wasn't he?
He wound him up somehow. I'm not sure what he did to wind him up. I mean, there was that tackle in the first half, but it was pretty innocent. And Haaland just seemed to have it in for him for the rest of the game.
Yeah, it's quite funny to watch, really. But still got his goal. He's on absolute fire at the minute. The rest has obviously not done him any harm at all. But in terms of the title race, is it beyond those two teams? Can you count Newcastle in that? Because Eddie Howe, in his post-match interview, didn't rule out the fact that they could run for the title. But how good are Newcastle? Do we even know yet? They've had a weird kind of return to Premier League action since the World Cup. They obviously convincingly beat Leicester 3-0, but then drew 0-0 with Leeds. So where do we put them now?
I think that's exactly what you expect of a side like Newcastle, who are still kind of developing their squad, still quite new under a manager that's bringing them some sort of success on the pitch. Results like the Leeds one happen, and I think they're still developing their identity as well, and we'll get a better picture of where Newcastle are by the end of January, both on results, because they've got some difficult games, and who they bring in. It'll be really interesting to see if they kind of fast forward their investment plan a little bit now that they are in the conversation of at least the top four, or maybe more. I don't think they'll have it in them for this season, but it's scary because if they're already at this level, where could they be next season with two more transfer windows? Eddie Howe's doing an absolutely fantastic job there. There's players there that are really shining. Almiron came back from the World Cup break and scored again. It didn't look like that affected him. So, yeah, Newcastle, I think they'll be finishing the top four. I'd be really surprised to see them drop out of the top four at this point, but probably too soon for a title. We'll see what they do in January. They could go out and just go absolutely mad in January, and all of a sudden we've got a completely different squad to talk about. That could disturb them. Who knows? They're really unpredictable, but I think they'll cement the top four.
I think the transfer policy, it's been phased quite nicely so far. They targeted what they really needed urgently, and that was the defence. And the defence looks great, really solid. So yeah, I think any quality, any stardust in the kind of mould of Bruno Guimarães, if they can get a player like that again for a decent fee, they could really start building a proper team, couldn't they? Because there's still a few weak areas in that Newcastle starting 11.
Yeah, I imagine they'll sniff back around James Maddison and see if they can bring him in. Yeah. I imagine they'll want at least one midfielder and one winger. The interesting one for Newcastle is up front, because they've got Callum Wilson, fantastic striker, pretty injury prone. Got Alexander Isak, an amazing signing, but he's been injured pretty much the entire time they've had him. And then Chris Wood, that was a bit of a filler signing last January, wasn't it? Don't want to sound disrespectful to Chris Wood, but that's not someone that is going to catapult you into a title race. So I wonder how ruthless they'll be in January and whether they might write a few players off that have otherwise been pretty good servants for him. You can't imagine we'll see a lot more of the likes of Jacob Murphy or Jonjo Shelvey after a couple more transfer windows, can you? So maybe Newcastle will act quickly in this window. There's definitely players on the market. And after the success that some people had at the World Cup, there'll be a lot of players on their radar too.
Yeah, interesting project to watch develop. And I think we'll both agree that they're ahead of schedule from where we thought they'd be, that's for sure. Do you remember last season we were predicting them for the drop? It's been a big turnaround since those days, hasn't it? But I want to get your thoughts on another top four contender who having a bit of an identity crisis as well, and that's Tottenham. Now, they were convincingly turned over by Villa 2-0, which obviously you'll be pleased to talk about in a moment. But if we can start with Spurs, first of all, their form's been so indifferent. And since the break for the World Cup, they've just been just as inconsistent, really, haven't they? They struggled and laboured to a 2-2 draw after going to behind as well on the Boxing Day fixtures. And then losing to Villa this time around as well, with some really defensively frail displays from a lot of their players. What's going on there? Is Conte even going to stay? What do they need to get some kind of stability in that team?
To be honest, you started this by referring to them as top four contenders, and I think they're already out of the conversation. I cannot see them picking up enough to compete at this point. They just look like they have no purpose at all. I don't really know what Spurs want to achieve this season. Conte doesn't seem to know what this group is capable of achieving. His comments after the match kind of suggested that maybe last season was a miracle and that maybe their level is fifth or sixth, which has got to be disappointing for Spurs fans and the owners, because they have backed him to a degree. Obviously, they brought in Richarlison on big money. They brought in Kulusevski, Bentancur. And all right, they're without those three players in this game. But then you wonder what the rest of Conte's business has done. What have we seen of Jed Spence, for example? Longley looked really poor in this game, I thought. It was so easy for Villa at times. Villa are not that clinical. I know we'll come on to Villa in a second, but they still managed to pull Spurs apart twice. A better team can do that far more often. And Spurs didn't look like they had any answers. And really, this squad is in massive need of a refresh. Lloris is past his best, definitely. Their defence, Christian Romero is a great centre-back, but is very, very erratic. And that is a problem in the Premier League. When you've got a league like we have over here that is quite physical and also quite fast-paced, you can't afford to have a big erratic centre-back sometimes. He was very lucky to stay on the pitch in this game, and that will cost Spurs, definitely. And then across the rest of their back line, Longley is poor. Ben Davies is not a centre-back. Their full-backs aren't good enough defensively at all. So I don't know what stability Spurs really have. Their only saving grace is they've got a good midfield who, even in this game, were off it. They massively didn't. Bissouma looked all over the shop. And Kane, obviously, is the only other, the bright spark right now. They've got Son, last season's top scorer, has scored 3 goals this season, all in one game. It's mental. He's been so poor. I just didn't see anything of Son in this game. Nothing like the player that we've come to know in the Premier League as one of the greatest players of the last 5-10 years, maybe, in the Premier League. But Where has that gone? Is that something Conte's done? Is that the player? Is it just people out of their prime? It just looks like Spurs need to tear it all up and start again. And I think that could come at the expense of making big money on Harry Kane in the summer if they're not careful.
Yeah, I do worry about the effect that on Antonio Conte's contract has on things, because it was only a short-term one anyway, really, by managerial standards. And surely the players must be thinking, you might not even be here come the summer. And that can't really be much good in terms of their forward planning as players as well. And they've had moments where they've looked great and they've looked like an Antonio Conte team and the spirit's come through. And they've come back from behind so many times that clearly there's some team spirit there. But like you say, there's just a lack of direction from the players they've signed. There's talk of Conte needing more money in January. And you think, well, you know, you've had a fair crack of the whip in the transfer window. Who else are you going to get? So what do they need? If not stability from the manager, then what kind of players are they missing, do you think?
I think they need at least 2 centre-backs, to be totally honest.
Wow.
I think if he's going to stick with a back three, Ben Davies is a great servant to Tottenham and he's very versatile and he's done well in that role for someone who's not a centre-back. But if you're aiming for the top four, you can't have fill-in players like that. Too often, that needs improving. Longley is nowhere near good enough. They need to make some sort of decision with Son, whether that be a change in coach that brings the best out of him, moving him on and getting money in for him while you still can, or just a conversation needs to be had or something. I don't know what's happened to him. It's bizarre. He's going to have some time out of the side, I think. As soon as Richarlison is back fit enough, I think you've got Ann Kulusevski, obviously. I don't think he should be starting games until he can show that he can have an impact on this side. That'll have to change. The thing is, Spurs have done so much in the last 2 transfer windows and brought in a lot of players. This is a very different Spurs squad. Did they make like 11 signings in the summer?
Well, we were, as I'm sure in a previous pod, we've got a pod where we were praising their transfer activity this summer. You know, with the likes of Bissouma, we were saying he's a standout midfielder, you know, the likes of Richarlison to rotate their attack. But the direction they've gone in has been very strange on the field, hasn't it?
They've not brought the best out of those players at all. And you can say that about Spurs for a really long time. When was the last time Spurs signed someone who was successful, really?
Christian Romero is probably the best one. And Kulusevski, obviously, as well. But they had a bit of a chance to try him before they actually bought him permanently.
Yeah. And even you can go further back than just Conte's era. Think about how much money they spent on the likes of Davinson Sanchez, Steven Bergwijn. It's really poor business from Spurs. And they've had some world-class managers in that time. And that's failed. So you've got to look at what the strategy of that club is. I don't think they have one. I absolutely don't. They spent so much money on the stadium and they seem to be determined to move forward, but they're not showing that on the pitch or in any of the footballing decisions that they're making. I mean, you go for Mourinho and don't like the football he's giving you. You bring in Nuno Espirito Santo, you don't like the football he's bringing you. You go to Conte. I can't see the process in that. There's no clear strategy. There's no plan, really. You're moving really similarly in the market, really, and not addressing that with the right players. If Conte is setting up to defend and then break teams down the last 20 minutes, you need good defenders. They've not brought that in. That seems obvious to me. It's a bizarre one. And Conte doesn't look happy at all. And that looks like it's set to blow up by the end of the season, isn't it?
Yeah, well, you've sort of said a few things there that sound so obvious, you know, all he needs to do is this, all they need to do is that. And I think from the outsiders, you can see Spurs and what they need, what ingredients would make them work. And that's the most frustrating thing, because I think most neutrals want Spurs to do well. You want Spurs to challenge. They've always been on the cusp of top four or even the title briefly. And it's sad to see them sliding. And I think they will. I don't think they'll be in top four. I agree with you. But let's not take anything away from Villa, whose identity crisis seems to be over with the new man in charge. Unai Emery is bringing some success to Villa, isn't he? And this game was, I don't know, a real example of how they've been more clinical, how they've got the best out of players like the goal scorers, Emi Buendia and Douglas Luiz, who took their goals superbly.
Yeah, it's by no means a finished article. And there's definitely work to be done in January. Emery will be really excited for that transfer window. But he's had four games now. We've had Brighton, Man United, Liverpool and Spurs. You could have easily said Villa would get no points from that. They've walked away with nine. Yeah. And actually, they played very well against Liverpool. They got cut open on a couple of silly occasions and they weren't clinical enough in that game. Had they had a better effort in front of goal, Leon Bailey was just terrible in that game. If he buried a couple of his chances, we could be talking about 12 points in Emery's first four games. And this is exactly the same squad so far that Steven Gerrard had. There's no one new in it.
Yeah.
And he's not done anything too radical, really, other than just play players in their best positions. He just seems to have identified, if you want these players to play well, there has to be some sort of tactical element that goes behind it. And it's worked. He had Spurs perfectly. He didn't attack them too much in the first half. He sat back, let them try and control the play and defended. Because he's seen what's happened if you go at Spurs in the first half, they come out in the second half for you. He went, okay, in the second half, that's when we'll press you high. That's when we'll win the ball higher in the pitch. McGinn, playing as almost like a false number 10, with this new role that Emery seems to have invented, is excellent there because that's what he's good at, pressing players, getting the ball high up the pitch, winning you free kicks there. I still think he looked quite poor on the ball until his assist, and there's a lot of work to be done before he's back to the John McGinn we know. But Emery is coaching these players well. Look at Douglas Luiz. Yeah. We've been saying for so long, Douglas Luiz could be a fantastic midfielder if he's coached well, if he's in the right system. They found the system. Putting him and Boubacar Kamara next to each other is perfect. That is a very, very good base of midfield. I don't think there are many teams in the Premier League that have one number six as good as either of those two, let alone having two of them. It's brilliant. I'm really excited by it. I think we've seen so much from Villa already. I think Ollie Watkins' work shows he can be part of a front two. They just need a more clinical striker next to him. I love Leon Bailey. I'm not saying I want him out of the side, but that's not his position. And I think if we brought in a real number nine, I know we have Danny Ings, but it doesn't seem like that works with Watkins. If we bring in a number nine who's more clinical, then there's no telling where Villa will end up this season. I think we could climb the table quite comfortably.
Yeah, to be honest, I think they're in that part of the table, that sort of, I don't know, 10th down to 15th, even higher actually, up to 8th, where there's not that much quality. So they could take advantage of that really with a few results strung together. And they have done so far because they looked mediocre when Steven Gerrard was in charge. But with the same team, they've climbed the table. Yeah, they've climbed the table pretty handsomely. I mean, tactically, they've tried to sort of always try and shoehorn a lot of different players in a system that works for players like Coutinho and for Buendia, who didn't even get a look in for a while, did he, under Gerrard? Who's going to be the players that will kind of suffer the most from having this guy in charge? Because Gerrard had his favourites, it was clear. Is there anybody you think who's going to be peripheral now into this new Villa regime?
I mean, even in this game, there was a point where Douglas Luiz had to come off. He picked up a little knock and he brought on Callum Chambers at the base of midfield, and Morgan Sanson is still sat on the bench. It looks like that's just never going to happen. It's a player that always looks quite quality when he plays, but Gerrard didn't like him, and it seems like Emery's not trusted him very much either. I don't think we'll sign the lone players that we've got on a permanent basis, or Gustinson or Bednarek, but that's not really a surprise. I don't know. I think Emery could get the best out of everyone in that squad. It was interesting to not see Emi Martinez back in this game, because Robin Olsen has a terrible record, has an absolutely terrible record. I think he was conceding a goal every 20 minutes in the Premier League before this game. So a great clean sheet for him too. And there is a little bit of talk that Emery and Martinez don't quite see eye to eye. So I really hope that's not the case and Villa don't try and cash in on him, because we've got a World Cup winning player in our team. But it looks like Emery's found a system that really matches this squad. There was a lot of talk that Coutinho might look to move back to Brazil in January. And he came out the other day and kind of quashed that rumour and said, I'm really, really happy here. I want to get back to my best. He's got over that injury now. And when he came on in this game, he did look class, to be honest. He didn't have a goal scoring moment or anything, but he was just calm on the ball. His defensive work was way better than I've ever seen it for Villa. That's what you want to see from him. And actually, in the second half of the season, if him and Buendia are ticking and we have them in those two number 10 roles, that could be something else. I wonder where John McGinn fits in long term. He's probably the one that I wonder about. Him and Danny Ings, I think, are the two that I'd look at and go, I'm not sure Emery will fancy you two. But I could be wrong. I hope I'm wrong. And we'll see what Villa do in January, because by all accounts, they're going to be very, very ambitious in this window. Some of the names being linked with us already, it's incredible, and it shows our intent.
Yeah. I'm going to move on to my boys now, just to round off the sort of top four teams that we've talked about. Only briefly, because the victory against Wolves was a routine one. It's Marcus Rashford's return to the team after his slap on the wrist by Erik ten Hag. But as an outsider, what do you make of United's recent form, I guess? Because, I mean, the start of the season was an absolute car crash. The first two results were awful. But they've been relatively kind of consistent since then, haven't they?
I think they might be nailed on for top four. I'm sure you won't be happy with me saying that. Don't want me to jinx it. But I think they look like the best of the rest at the moment, definitely. Ten Hag seems to have finally got his philosophy across with a lot of players. Having the Ronaldo situation sewn up and done, that will obviously really help. And Rashford's form, that's exactly what you want from Marcus Rashford. And actually, it solves a lot of problems without having to dip massively into the transfer market. There's a few little things that I look at and think United need to address them quickly. The Harry Maguire situation seems the most obvious one. He's got to be looking for another club now, surely. If he's fit and on the bench while Luke Shaw's playing centre-back, and playing centre-back very well, by the way, a lot of credit to him. But if you're Maguire, club captain, and you're sat on the bench with a fullback in your position, it's not looking good. But on the pitch, yeah, United are really clicking. They seem to know how to play this Ten Hag style of football. Their counter-attack is really, really lethal. And Wolves have looked decent in the last couple of games. So this was, it was a routine win, but Man United made it look easier than it was in many ways. And they have that guy in form right now. And that always carries teams over the line in this sort of period.
Yeah, I'm interested to see what the future for Marcus Rashford looks like from Erik ten Hag's point of view in terms of what position he sees him playing. Because I think he does like to see him through the middle quite a lot. But I honestly do feel like we need a very direct number nine, if not in January, in the summer, just to see how we can have that focal point in attack and what that would do to the style of play that we have. We definitely need a centre back, as you've kind of alluded to. And I think we need a goalkeeper as well, because he doesn't really 100% trust David De Gea. We've let Martin Dubravka go back to Newcastle because he was awful. Dean Henderson, I don't think, got a future at United either. I don't think his temperament will fit with Erik ten Hag's kind of philosophy of teamwork. And he's started taking control of the reserve team now just to see the pathway from reserves to the first team. So he's kind of following his Ajax model a little bit closer now. And I'm see how this discipline and this finding the right players for the right positions and not shoehorning people in will kind of transform us over the next couple of transfer windows.
Yeah, I'm really interested to see what you do in January now, because elephant in the room, you didn't get Cody Gakpo. And there's no hiding from that. United wanted him. There's no glossing that over and pretending that this isn't a loss. Liverpool have picked your pocket for the second time since Ten Hag's been there. It could have been Nunes. It wasn't. Could have been Gakpo. It wasn't. So there's obviously a need for an attacker. I'm not sure who that is in the market now, because the players that you were looking at in the summer, some of them have dropped in form. Some of them now look unattainable. If you look at Victor Osimhen, Napoli are not going to sell him in January while they're competing for the title. Definitely not. If you look at Tammy Abraham, his goal scoring form has been woeful this season. He might not be a player that United are even considering anymore. So there isn't an obvious player to fill the void at Man United, I don't feel. Obviously, João Felix is one that's been talked about for all Premier League clubs, Chelsea, Arsenal, United, even Villa got mentioned for him. So he might be one that United go for, but I don't know how well that fits what Ten Hag's trying to do right now, or how well he fits the side. I think he'd probably come in and replace Martial, maybe. I don't know.
Yeah, I think it's another one. Martial is not 100% convinced by him either, just from a temperament point of view. But I do feel like he's probably got his eye on somebody like, I've heard Memphis Depay's name mentioned, because he's available on a free, I think, in this summer. This summer he'll be available. If not for a cut price fee in January this month. We're in the transfer window now. And also, I think I've heard rumours of Dusan Vlahovic as well for a cut price, because he's had a really rough season, hasn't he, as Juventus have too. So who knows?
You don't want him right now, though. That's not where you want to sign players from, where they're in a bad moment, is it? You want to do like Liverpool have done and identified talented players in good moments that you think can kick on to the next level, not kind of take someone's rejects. And if you buy Depay off Barcelona because they've kind of replaced him and moved on, if you buy Vlahovic from Juventus because that's not really worked out, that's not guaranteed success there, really, is it? Wow. I feel like United need to be a bit smarter in the market like that. Like bringing Casemiro in, for example, excellent signing. Yeah. Someone who's just come off the back of winning the Champions League and the league. He looked phenomenal last season. And he has completely changed United's midfield. He's filled that gap that was just obviously there for 5, 6, 7 years. And that worked. If you're trying to do the same with your forward line, I think you've got to be really, really careful of who you bring in, to be honest.
I think just a note on Casemiro as well. The way he's transformed United's rhythm, the way they play their focus points in attack and in defence, the way he breaks it up and spreads it around, I just think it goes so unnoticed if you're not a football fan. Like, you wouldn't know Casemiro was a great player if you didn't understand football, but he just maintains rhythm. He's a fantastic footballer. And I think it was against Forest after Christmas. He was superb, rightly man of the match as well, I think, in the end. So yeah, I think he's one of the players that, like you rightly point out, we need to kind of be going for, because the caliber of that player and what he brings to the team is almost instant. But however, we're being sold. So there's uncertainty financially about how much is available right now. So there's that question.
Even that's uncertain, isn't it? It's not certain that it's up for sale. There's also talk that it's just investment. It's a bit messy, but we're kind of used to that from Man United's boardroom at the moment, aren't we? It never seems coherent. And obviously, it's probably worth mentioning really quickly, Ronaldo found himself.
That was literally my next point to ask you as well, because, I mean, there's interviews very recently where he's saying, so many players go to these different inferior leagues to retire in their 35, 36, 37 age bracket. Not me. That's not for me. He's finding himself unable to find a club of the calibre he thinks he's still at. And he's had the biggest reality check ever, hasn't he, by having to go to Saudi Arabia. I mean, what's your feelings as a neutral about Ronaldo's situation?
He knew it was coming, definitely. You could see it in the Piers Morgan interview when Piers said to him, "You turned down that move to Saudi Arabia in the summer. That's how I know you're not in it for the money." And he went, "Yeah, for now." He kind of panicked a little bit, like, "Don't say that, Piers, because I'm going to do that in a few weeks." It's sad to see it go the way it's gone. And to do that off the back of, obviously, all the narrative always is Ronaldo, Messi, Ronaldo, Messi. When you've just watched Messi lift a World Cup and you're now going over to Saudi Arabia, that's really frustrating. And actually, it ties perfectly into the plan of Saudi Arabia in terms of expanding football in the Middle East. Obviously, they've got their foothold in the Premier League with buying Newcastle. They're bidding for the 2030 World Cup. They've now got Ronaldo to be the poster boy, and they've got Messi on board to do the same thing for their tourism. It's growing. And in some ways, that's wonderful. And it should happen. Football is everyone's game. It's the world's game. I want to see it be successful in all corners of the globe, as long as it's presented in the right ways and done in the correct manner. The money Ronaldo is on out there is absolutely terrifying and almost feels unethical. I never want to moan about what a footballer earns, because at the end of the day, if a crazy billionaire wants to come to England and pay a player £300,000 a week and half of that goes into our tax system, okay, that's just what the market value is. It doesn't stop me from sleeping at night. I don't think it's brilliant either. It's one of those things. But Ronaldo's figures, it's frightening. Something like $6 a second or something like that. $8 a second.
Yeah.
Like, that's just frightening money, isn't it?
Obscene. And it's not what he's worth right now either. I think that's the biggest kind of realization he's probably had. I don't know, has he? But we definitely have as football fans, is that he's not at that level anymore. And I think leaving United was worst thing he could have done.
But commercially, he's worth it.
Yeah, maybe. I mean, that's proven with their followers on Instagram or something have kind of quadrupled or something since he's been there. But from a Man United fan's perspective, really sad. I think he still had part to play in our squad. He could have passed on so much knowledge to this Man United team. He could have stayed in the system, become a coach. But no, he wanted to be the number one. And the only way to do that was to go to a club that would literally make him the biggest asset that they have, and that is sadly a club in Saudi Arabia. So yeah,
well, I don't know, we all saw Vincent Aboubakar's chip in the World Cup. I'm not sure Ronaldo's even the best striker they've got there right now.
I think like you say, in the year that Messi lifted the World Cup, it is kind of the greatest contrast between the two now, isn't it? And I know there's a couple of years between them, but you'd like to think that Messi would know when his time is up and kind of bow out in a graceful way. Ronaldo's gone the least graceful way probably could. And he had it there for him to finish on a high with either United or Sporting even, and he chose not to. So yeah, sad for football, but good luck to him nonetheless. That's all I can say. But that's it for today's pod, I think.
Just one quick mention, another sad note for football, sadly, but Pele passed away the other day.
Oh, God, yeah. Do you know what? That's something that I shouldn't have overlooked, really. But yeah, what a huge, huge figure missing from the game of football now. Yeah, that's a real sad loss.
And I think when you see any Brazilian player this weekend, even in England, and the impact it's clearly had on them, the tributes that were happening across the Premier League for a player that never played in this country other than for the odd friendly or an international fixture, you can see his impact on the game. One of the most influential footballers of all time, if not the greatest footballer of all time. It's sad because obviously we lost Maradona as well, and Pelé. It's bizarre really to see that kind of sphere changing so much, but yes, sad lot in football.
It is, but I think even the generation like ours, where we didn't really see him play, we've only seen grainy video clips, and you know, we don't know how good a player he is. We only know what we've been told to an extent, but his impact on the game was huge. And I think that's one of the things where kids, I guess, from our generation and younger, will kind of go, well, who influenced football the most out of all these players? It's probably Pelé, and his influence on World Cups, especially on the international stage, was huge. So yeah, huge loss.
I saw a compilation the other day, and obviously that's how football is consumed these days, compilation videos on Twitter, but a video of Pelé doing various different skills or things that all of our favourite modern footballers have kind of done and made famous, like way before they've ever even existed. And it's scary to see the technical ability he had in a game that actually wasn't built like that, didn't have the modern facilities, the modern training systems, the kind of pitches, technology available to him that players now have. But what he was able to do with the football, frightening, absolutely phenomenal. So yeah, real sad one.
Yeah. On that note, on that little fitting tribute to Pelé, we'll bid you farewell for now. Thank you for joining us again for our first pod of the new year. Thanks, Miles, for chipping in again. Pleasure to have you as always. And yeah, see you on the next pod.